Good morning. Many Democrats are unhappy that a few of their colleagues voted to reopen the government. We've heard some of them on this program. Today we hear a case that Democrats may actually gain from this. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy says air travel will take time to get back to normal even after the shutdown ends. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Duffy says more than a dozen air traffic controllers are retiring every day. Also, President Trump is suggesting 50-year mortgages as a way to lower monthly housing costs, but overall expenses to own a house would go up. And how Trump attacks on the Smithsonian are affecting museums across the country. It's Wednesday, November 12th. Happy birthday to actor Ryan Gosling, who turns 45 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The House of Representatives is expected to approve legislation later today. It would end the longest federal government shutdown in U.S. history. NPR's Deirdre Walsh reports few Democrats are expected to back the bill.
The Senate approved a bill that would fund most agencies through the end of January and include full-year funding for veterans programs and food assistance. Most Democrats criticized the deal for failing to address expiring health care subsidies. The top Senate Republican did pledge to hold a vote in December on a health care bill, but House Speaker Mike Johnson says he won't guarantee a House vote. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries is urging fellow Democrats to vote no.
We're not going to support a partisan Republican spending bill that continues to gut the health care of the American people.
If the House approves the measure, it will head to the White House for the president's signature, ending the shutdown. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, the Capitol.
The U.S. Supreme Court is postponing its decision on whether the federal government must fully fund SNAP food assistance. The delay lasts until late Thursday. That could give Congress time to end the shutdown. NPR's Tovia Smith reports if the shutdown ends, the SNAP issue would no longer be relevant for the high court.
The Trump administration had asked the court to block a lower court order forcing the government to fully fund SNAP benefits, saying that was not the judiciary's call. The administration pressed the case, even as it acknowledged that the deal now advancing to end the shutdown would restore full funding. One lawyer for the administration told a lower court that would happen as soon as 24 hours later. The Supreme Court did not speak to the merits of the case, but in a three-sentence order, it did note that Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, who allowed a previous pause while the case was on appeal, would not have allowed the Trump administration to continue avoiding full SNAP payments. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
The government shutdown continues to slow airline traffic. There are nearly 900 flight cancellations so far today, according to the tracking site FlightAware.com. Yesterday, more than 1,200 flights were canceled. President Trump is defending visas for foreign skilled workers who come to the U.S. The visa program is called H-1B. Speaking to Laura Ingraham on the Ingraham Angle show on Fox, Trump said the U.S. had to bring in foreign skilled workers.
You can't just say country's coming in, going to invest $10 billion to build a plant, and going to take people off an unemployment line who haven't worked in 5 years, and they're going to start making missiles. It doesn't work that way.
Despite the support, Trump recently ordered a new fee for some people seeking H-1B visas. The fee is $100,000. The Trump administration says that visa fee will only be paid by new applicants who are living abroad. You're listening to NPR. U.S. Catholic bishops have selected Oklahoma City Archbishop Paul Coakley to lead them. Coakley is an advisor to a group of strongly conservative Catholic leaders. In addition, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is now going to focus heavily on immigration issues. Social media lit up overnight. Thanks to a solar storm, the northern lights were visible across much of the country, as NPR's Giles Snyder reports.
The northern lights are typically limited to places like Alaska and northern Canada, but social media users as far south as Alabama and Florida were able to step outside and snap pictures of the colorful displays in the night sky. A severe solar storm brought the auroras much further south than usual. But while the display sparked social media joy, space weather forecasters warned of potential complications. Geomagnetic storms can temporarily disrupt radio and satellite operations. According to experts at NASA and the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, the sun is in an active phase that's expected to last until at least through the end of the year. Giles Snyder, NPR News.
A watchdog group is calling on artificial intelligence company OpenAI to withdraw its new AI video app. The group, Public Citizen, says the Sora 2 app is spreading deep fake disinformation, creating digital harassment, and lacks any protections for people who hold copyrights. OpenAI has already reached an agreement with the family of Martin Luther King Jr. This is to stop disrespectful and fake videos of the slain civil rights leader. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
I think I'll go for a walk outside now. The summer sun's calling my name.
Maureen McCormick was not Marcia Brady, the Goody Two Shoes older sister she'd played in the ABC sitcom The Brady Bunch from 1969 to 1974.
Oh, Marcia, I've been looking for you.
Me?
Yeah.
By the early 1980s, McCormick was coming out of a very un-Brady-like 5-year addiction to cocaine.
Great.
But everywhere she went, she was still...
Marcia, Marcia, Marcia!
Who was she without Marcia Brady or her drugs? One night she went out to a concert, and there locked eyes with someone she'd never met before. Michael Cummings, a Minnesota actor who'd honed his skills at Minneapolis's Children's Theater Company before going Hollywood.
It's nice to know there's a
she liked him immediately, enough to start showing up at his Bible study class. And he was the one who said they couldn't date anymore when she relapsed into drugs. And the one, a newly sober Maureen McCormick, married in 1985, joining the Cummings Bunch at their annual summer retreat on Minnesota's Lake Vermilion.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ian Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Some Democrats are so unhappy with the deal to end the government shutdown, we cannot play all of their words on the radio. Consider Peggy Flanagan, Lieutenant Governor of Minnesota, talking on Facebook.
We deserve so much more than this.
Ooh, sorry, little glitch there at the end.
Yep.
Some Senate Democrats broke with the rest of their party and joined Republicans to pass the bill earlier this week. Flanagan, let's hear from her again.
We deserve so much more than this.
Yeah, Flanagan is running to join the Senate. She said last week's election results mean it's time to fight.
Especially when we saw victories up and down the ballot all across the country. People were with us, and then this.
For example, Mikey Sherrill won the New Jersey governor's race in that election. She called the agreement malpractice. Democratic Congressman Richie Torres of New York was on this program on Monday and said he's voting against the Senate bill when it gets to the House.
Because it's not a deal. It's an unconditional surrender that abandons 24 million Americans. We're about to see their premiums more than double.
Former North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper, who is running to flip a Senate seat there, said, quote, any deal that lets health care costs continue to skyrocket is unacceptable.
So let's explain a couple of things here. Enhanced subsidies for people who buy insurance through federal marketplaces were introduced during the pandemic in 2021. Then they were extended by the Inflation Reduction Act. Now, those subsidies are the ones that will expire at the end of this year. And that's why Democrats rejected a short-term spending bill more than a month ago, which wound up triggering the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. Now, the Senate bill would reopen the government, but does not address health care costs. But as part of the deal that attracted a few Democrats, Senate Majority Leader John Thune said he would let Democrats choose a health care proposal and then hold a vote next month.
Democrat Tim Kaine of Virginia is one of the senators who voted for the bill. He told NPR's Here and Now it's an opening for his party.
We got a fighting chance of winning this, healthcare vote. Dems have got the high ground on it now. People know we're fighting for them. We're going to continue to do it.
Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman also voted to reopen the government, telling NPR's All Things Considered that it was reckless to shut it down in the first place.
I absolutely support extending those tax credits. But for me, the kinds of chaos and holding our government hostage is unacceptable.
Congressman Seth Moulton of Massachusetts is another Democrat hoping to join the Senate. Yesterday on Morning Edition, he said Chuck Schumer should no longer lead their party in the Senate.
I think there's a leadership vacuum in the Democratic Party right now, and it's time for a new generation of Democrats to step up.
Democrats' frustration definitely extends to Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, who voted no on the funding bill the way a lot of Democrats would have liked, but was unable to keep his caucus united. Josh Barrow wrote in the New York Times about this, saying that Schumer is, quote, a convenient punching bag and that things may work out better for Democrats than some would suggest. He hosts the podcast Serious Trouble, and some listeners may also know him as the former host of Left, Right, and Center from our member station, KCRW. Josh, good morning.
Good morning, Stu.
Good to talk with you. Do you think there is a Democratic leadership vacuum?
I mean, I think, yes, I think there is a need for, you know, for new generations of leadership for the Democratic Party in Congress, but not because new leadership would have been able to produce an outcome that was any better in this specific instance.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, this is the eighth multi-day government shutdown that has happened since government shutdowns were created at the end of the Carter administration.
Right.
Before that, they used to just keep the government open even if appropriations lapsed. And in all eight of those showdowns, there has never been a significant policy concession to the side that was forcing the shutdown, making a policy demand. It has not worked when Republicans have done it. It has not worked in the past when Democrats have done it. For example, in 2018, when they were trying to get codified protections for the Dreamers, which they did not get in that government shutdown. And in this specific instance, the reason for that is one that Democrats kept saying over and over, which is that Republicans had the majority in Congress and they had the presidency, and they did not actually need Democratic votes in order to reopen the government. Now, obviously, you have this filibuster barrier in the Senate, but you also, I mean, earlier this year when they passed the One Big Beautiful Bill, the filibuster was in their way and they created a new exception effectively, allowing them to do an end run around the filibuster and avoid Democratic votes. And if push had come to shove here in the end, and Republicans had decided that they had run out of patience with the unpleasantness of the shutdown, which they had not really come close to yet, they would have been able to find one way or another to reopen the functions of the government without Democratic votes. So there was no indication the Republicans were going to be anywhere close to actually giving Democrats their policy demand on the Obamacare exchanges or any other major policy area of government here. The question was fold now or fold later.
Well, if that was the reality, is there something to be said for the Tim Kaine case here, which is essentially we've made our point, we've highlighted our concerns, the public knows what side we're on, and maybe we won here?
Absolutely. I think, you know, first of all, they did win a small policy concession, which is that they reversed any layoffs that the president had ordered during the shutdown. And furthermore, he's not allowed to make any through the duration of this continuing resolution, which is through the end of January. And my expectation is that if there are further continuing resolutions after that, that they will extend that prohibition. They also got a couple of other minor spending items, including related to the Government Accountability Office. So this has been the typical thing going back years when these shutdowns end. Is you get this sort of fig leaf for the side that had forced the shutdown. But again, it's not nothing, especially in Virginia, which Kaine represents in the Senate. Ultimately, they shouldn't have forced this shutdown at all because the shutdowns never work. Now, that said, I think as a political matter, there was tremendous demand on the Democratic side, not just from activists, but from voters and from even Democratic office holders to have this sort of show of a fight to give the shutdown a try and see what it would do. And so now I think we have seen that, you know, you can cause significant political pain to the president. His poll numbers did deteriorate, especially over the second half of October. I think they goaded the president into doing some things on food stamps that are unpopular and that might hurt Republicans even in the election next year. But at some point, you reach diminishing returns on that. And if you keep the shutdown continuing, you just have more government workers who haven't been paid, more people who haven't received their food stamps, more air traffic control towers that are unstaffed. And at some point, that becomes untenable. And so to keep that going just to get some more, you know, unpleasant news cycles for the president, I don't think makes sense as a way to run the government. And again, it was not ultimately going to get them the policy change they wanted on the health insurance exchange.
And if you're a Democrat, you're concerned about President Trump, you're thinking about the 2026 elections. And I'm thinking that through. I'm recalling, Well, we could talk about a lot of different shutdowns, but 2013, I recall that Ted Cruz individually drove the government into a shutdown, and this was immediately analyzed as a disaster for Republicans, was going to be terrible in the following midterm elections. And of course, by the time the elections came, nobody even remembered the shutdown, and Republicans did great. I suppose right. There's a case that they've positioned themselves, Democrats have now positioned themselves in such a way that they might be in better shape for 2026.
Marginally better. I mean, I think to your point, that a year is a long time from now, and I don't think that this is going to be fresh in voters' memories in either direction. I mean, I'm not sure that the food stamp fight will be fresh in their memories either a year from now if the food stamp program is operating normally in a year. But yes, I think that, you know, they've notched some political wins here, and, you know, to the extent the sort of people who are angriest at Democrats about doing this are also the sort of people who would crawl across broken glass in order to vote for Democrats in an election. So, you know, that those people are displeased, I understand that, but ultimately they're displeased because they want something they can't have, which is they want control of the policy agenda after having lost the next election. What they have to go do is they have to go vote next year, and if they get control of one or more chambers of the House of Representatives or of the Congress, then they will have control over, you know, how the government spends money in 2027 and onward. And that's what Democrats need to do.
Just got about 20 seconds here, but I want to ask about Republicans. Do Republicans get any credit for declining the president's order to end the filibuster? It's one of the few times in Congress when they haven't exactly done what he said.
Well, I mean, I don't, you know, in the long run, I don't think the filibuster is necessarily a great way to run our legislature. And if I was picking an area for Republicans to have a spine, I would probably pick something else. But it does demonstrate they don't do exactly what he wants.
Josh Barrow, writer and podcast host, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Steve.
2 years ago, a small town newspaper in Kansas published an embarrassing secret about one of the town's business owners. Then police illegally raided the Marion County Record. Now, Marion County is paying millions of dollars to the paper and others harassed in the raids. Here's Frank Morris of member station KCUR.
On a Friday morning in August of 2023, the entire 5-member Marion, Kansas police force and 2 sheriff's deputies stormed the Marion County Record, hauling off computers and reporters' cell phones. Then they raided and searched the publisher's home, confronting his 98-year-old mother.
Don't you touch any of that stuff.
This home surveillance video shows Joan Meyer standing up to armed officers, slamming her walker on the floor.
This is my house.
The police stayed 2.5 hours. Meyer died the following day, but not before calling the raid Hitler tactics. The searches came on the heels of stories in the paper revealing that a politically connected restaurant owner in town had been driving for years without a license because of a drunk driving conviction. The stated reason for the raid was that the paper got the damaging information illegally. In fact, it was just a reporter confirming a tip on a public website. The raid smacked of retribution, and it shook up Marion County resident Whitney Douglas.
The police get to control what information we are allowed to know about. Then where does that take us as a culture?
The raid spurred a nationwide conversation about that. Marion County Record publisher Eric Meyer says he got tens of thousands of encouraging messages.
The raid was terrible. The fact that it cost my mother her life was terrible. But the outpouring of support after the raid was so incredible.
Now the county must pay a bit more than $3 million, split between Meyer, 2 former reporters, and the town's former vice mayor, whose home was also raided that day. The county sheriff's department apologized and admitted that the raids weren't legal. That's not the end of it. Meyer says he'll continue to press his lawsuit against the city. The town's former police chief faces a criminal charge for allegedly interfering with the state's investigation of the raid. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.
This is NPR News.
I'm Heidi Holton. We're excited at KEXE to be bringing you more jazz programming with our volunteer, Paul Kivi, the history of jazz.
Well, I think this is some of the finest music ever made, and it's kind of gotten lost across time. I pick the songs that I love, and there's lots of them, and there's lots to love. The popular music in the late 20s and 30s, especially the 30s and 40s with the big band era, that was jazz. That was the one period of time when jazz was popular music. And so you're going to hear a lot of things that are easy to get into. If you develop a taste for it, then the stuff that happens starting with Charlie Parker in the late 1940s makes sense.
Hear the history of jazz on KAXE with Paul Kivi, Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. And from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Enemy Martinez. President Trump has a suggestion to lower monthly mortgage payments. He posted a picture on Truth Social this weekend titled Great American Presidents. It has a portrait of FDR under the banner 30-year mortgage. Now above Trump's head, 50-year mortgage. Susan Wachter is a professor of real estate and finance at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. Susan, so a 50-year mortgage, would that make housing more affordable?
It might. It's not a good substitute for a 30-year mortgage because it comes with risks, risk to the borrower and to the overall market.
Yeah, because when you think about it, if it's going to be 20 more years than a 30-year mortgage, the risks are there, right? Anything could happen in between those 20 years that could really be disastrous.
Exactly. And not just the risk, but you're not building up wealth, which is one of the points of being a homeowner, is to build that wealth that you can't do as a renter.
Yeah, because then the interest rate piles up. That's something you still have to pay, and you're paying that for a longer amount of time. But what about the argument that, hey, it's going to lower monthly payments? So if it's going to lower monthly payments, it'll help people get into housing.
It will. And that's the plus side. That's the small silver lining of this problematic cloud. But it's not going to take over the market simply because of the risks involved. But we've got to do something. And getting people into homeownership in a market where rents are going up, because that's where the jobs are, is a challenge and an important challenge for local markets and for America as a whole. This is a generation that's at a point where they would become homeowners, and they're simply not. And hope is a problem, hope to become a homeowner and overcome that threat of being evicted as a renter.
But
as rents go up.
You mentioned hope, though, and that's something that's very important to people. You got to have the hope to be able to accomplish things, to kind of go out and maybe even get through your day sometimes, I think. But when I think about it, according to the National Association of Realtors, the first-time buyer typical average age is about 40, an all-time high of 40, which would mean if someone takes this 50-year mortgage, they'd be 90 before they paid off the loan. I mean, I don't know. I can't even plan for next week. Susan, can you imagine planning 50 years ahead of time?
Exactly. That's all that wraps it up, that this is not the solution. However, we need to find a solution. And this can, lowering the mortgage payments in the short run, temporarily, as well as lower down payments for a select portion of the population. Some localities who are already subsidizing homeownership because they need those workers and subsidizing renting, there are a number of potential possibilities, and we need all hands on deck approach to solving this affordability problem.
Sometimes when people have a mortgage, they refinance to maybe take care of other bills, things that may come up that you can't control. With a 50-year mortgage, can you see that as a possibility too?
Yes, would
you
be exactly. able to refinance? That could happen for small. That's exactly for a small segment of the population that could be for local governments who also at the same time provide more housing, more physical housing, because ultimately this is a supply problem. We don't have those starter homes.
Is a 50-year mortgage even legal?
No, that's a big question. Right now, FHFA, which is the overseer of Fannie and Freddie, precludes it. So we're a long way from actually seeing a product such as this.
Now, yeah, and you mentioned just more housing, right? That's the simple answer when it comes to improving housing affordability is having more homes available. But how likely is that?
Well, I do think that there's more attention to this issue. And I do think there's room for more supply. We used to be a nation that did supply housing. I think there are steps we can take. And I think that mortgage market and interest rates are part of the problem and will have to be part of the solution. But this is not an instrument that's going to solve for most millennials and Generation Z and even the next generation up to have the options and hope that their siblings and parents had.
That's Susan Wachter, professor of real estate and finance at the Wharton School of Business. Susan, thank you.
Thank you.
A trade group for American museums puts together a national snapshot of how that industry is doing, from art museums to zoos. NPR's Andrew Limbong looked at this year's version.
For 2025, the snapshot isn't great.
The headline here is that, first time since the pandemic, we're seeing museums recovery in reverse.
That's Marilyn Jackson, president and CEO of the American Alliance of Museums. And she says museums stalling in their pandemic recovery is due to a few things. One, the federal government pulling grant funding earlier this year.
It's thrown the sector into a tailspin.
Two, when President Trump issued an executive order criticizing the Smithsonian's divisive racial ideology and called museums woke, Jackson said that led to other sources of funding drying up.
We're seeing corporations and foundations thinking twice about funding certain projects or programs that they would have naturally funded in the past.
Add on top of this, people not going out like they used to, families tightening their budgets, tourism declining, and you have a recipe for attendance being down at museums compared to last year.
What we are seeing and what we expect to see more of is program cuts for after-school programs, programs or curriculum offered to schools and school programming, programs for seniors and veterans, and also stalling or cutting of new exhibitions, new maintenance projects.
The cuts to programming aimed at kids and schools is particularly worrying to Jackson, not just in terms of this year and next, but big picture.
There's an old adage that if you didn't go to a museum as a child, you're not going to go as an adult.
Is there any graph in here in this report that's like not a silver lining, but something to hang on some hope onto about the future of museums?
Well, I believe that museum professionals are creative problem solvers who will adapt and will continue to find ways to offer programs.
Some programs. Again, museums will be making a lot of cuts to stay afloat. And Jackson says people will start to feel the brunt of those cuts. The hope is that
people will start to demand more for their communities and will ask for funding for their museums.
The future of museums depends on it. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
The International Space Station has been orbiting Earth for 25 years now, and astronauts aboard have had to follow some key rules for staying alive in space.
You always have to respect the laws of physics and recognize that the laws of physics will always win.
I'm Scott Detrow. A new documentary tells the origins of the ISS on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show. My name is Andrew DeZingle. The KXC News Team has put together a list of food-related resources across northern Minnesota. You'll find hours of operation and locations of food shelves, along with information on soup kitchens and community meals. Go to kaxc.org. If you have something to add, email news@kaxe.org. Watermark Arts Center has their final poetry slam of the year Thursday, November 20th at Fozzie's Barbecue in Bemidji. Music begins at 6 with poetry at 7. Poets should prepare 3 original poems, each under 3 minutes. Contact Watermark Arts Center to guarantee your spot. Itasca Housing Resource Team hosts Soup on the Street Wednesday, November 19th on the grounds of Old Central School in Grand Rapids from 3 to 5 p.m. Stand in solidarity with those experiencing housing insecurity and hunger. Donations of hats, mittens, and scarves will be accepted, and soup will be served. United Way of Northeastern Minnesota invites high school seniors to write an essay on the biggest need you see in your community and your ideas to address that need. Open to those in Coochiching and Lake of the Woods County, plus the entire Iron Range. Find more at UnitedWayNEMN.org. The deadline is January 1st. Great Lakes Area Performing Arts will hold auditions for the Tin Woodman of Oz, November 17th and 18th, from 6 to 9 both nights at Pequot Lakes High School Auditorium. There are roles for adults and youth ages 10 and up. The Minnesota Department of Transportation will hold an open house about the Highway 34 corridor study Tuesday, November 18th from 4 to 6 at Park Rapids City Hall. Now we'll take you back to Morning Edition here on member-supported radio, KAXE KBXE.
On today's date, November 12th in the year 2009, a buddy of mine and I are out doing a little duck hunting. And as you might expect, there are a few ducks around. But those that remain here include a feisty, speedy, diminutive member of the duck family, the bufflehead. The bufflehead is a remarkable duck. The male is mostly white, has a little bit of black on it here and there, but largely white when you see it in its breeding plumage. The female is more gray. Both have large heads with large patches of white feathers on the backs of the heads. They are cavity nesters. In their breeding areas, they nest in small flocks, and they can aggregate into very large flocks. They spend a lot of time diving and eating clams and other crustaceans, insect larvae, whatever they can find at the bottom of a lake. And they then start their way south sort of later than other ducks. They're well past the end of the mallards and the scaup and others that would be up in front of them. And when they fly, the wind over their wings can make a sharply whistling sound, and so they're sometimes known as whistlers. Typically, when I see the whistlers, I know that the duck hunting season is coming to an end.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Even if the U.S. government shutdown ends this week, flight disruptions are likely to linger.
Airlines have canceled thousands of flights, as you may have heard, to comply with an order from the Federal Aviation Administration to keep the skies safe. And airlines are expecting to cancel thousands more by this weekend as air traffic restrictions ramp up.
NPR transportation correspondent Joel Rose is here. So, Joel, where do things stand with these air traffic reductions?
Yeah, not only are they still in place, but as we heard, the cuts are actually increasing. The FAA ordered airlines to cut 10% of air traffic at dozens of major airports. So airlines have been gradually building toward that target. The FAA says it is dealing with persistent shortages of air traffic controllers and that this step was necessary to relieve the pressure on controllers who are coming to work. Air traffic controllers, of course, don't get paid until the shutdown ends, and they have now missed two full paychecks. Some have taken on second jobs, and many have called out sick during the shutdown. Over the weekend, dozens of facilities reported staffing shortages, leading to some of the worst delays since the shutdown began. Staffing levels did improve yesterday, with only a handful of facilities reporting shortages. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy called that a good sign, but he said these restrictions will remain in place until regulators are satisfied that staffing is back to normal levels.
And has Duffy given any indication on when those restrictions could be lifted?
No. Duffy spoke yesterday at a press conference at O'Hare Airport in Chicago, and he declined to give any kind of timetable for when these restrictions could be lifted. Instead, he painted a picture of more chaos in the aviation system if lawmakers do not vote to reopen the government.
If this doesn't open, you might have airlines that say, we're gonna ground our planes. We're not going to fly anymore. That's how serious this is. You may find airlines that stop flying. Full stop.
I should note that so far no airline has said that, at least not in public. Duffy also said controllers would get some of the money that they're due quickly when the government reopens. A big chunk, about 70% of that within 48 hours, he said. But even so, Duffy says it may take time for staffing levels to recover.
So on the airlines, how quickly can they get back to a normal flying schedule?
That is another challenge. Airlines will likely need a few days to get back to their full schedules. Randy Babbitt is a former administrator of the FAA. He spoke yesterday on NPR's All Things Considered, and here's some of what he said.
The airplanes are in the wrong cities and so forth. They're going to have to sort all of that out as well. So a good deal of responsibility will be the carriers getting, you know, their schedules and the aircraft and personnel back in the right positions to resume normal flying.
An airline industry trade group, Airlines for America, also said there could be residual delays for days, even after the government reopens.
Why did the Trump administration decide to put these restrictions in place when it did?
There has been debate around whether this is really all about safety, as the administration says, or about politics. To the Trump administration's critics, the timing of the move appears to be political. Some Democrats say that Duffy's increasingly dire predictions about the air traffic system seem calculated to raise the pressure on them to vote to reopen the government. Secretary Duffy rejects the charge that this is about politics. He says the administration is responding to real safety concerns, including complaints from pilots and increasing loss of separation between aircraft and flight. The Air Traffic Controllers Union says, you know, the controllers are the rope in this political tug of war, that the pressure and stress on them keep mounting. And some are just opting out. Secretary Duffy says that 15 to 20 controllers are simply retiring every day during the shutdown.
That's NPR's Joel Rose in Washington. Joel, thanks.
You're welcome.
Okay, we have some idea of the force the United States is massing in or near the Caribbean Sea. We do not have a clear idea of what the U.S. plans to do with it.
The world's largest aircraft carrier, the Gerald R. Ford, is now in the area covered by the U.S. Southern Command. Now, that's the part of the world that includes Venezuela. In recent weeks, U.S. forces already in the region have opened fire on small boats, killing at least 76 people. And the U.S. is saying that they were smuggling drugs, though any evidence of that is really at the bottom of the sea.
Does the United States have some larger plan? Quill Lawrence from NPR's National Security Team is going to work through the evidence for us. Quill, good morning.
Good morning.
What does an aircraft carrier have to do with stopping drugs?
This isn't how the U.S. has ever fought against narco trafficking in the past. I'm just blowing boats out of the water. Then with the Secretary of Defense sharing a grainy video on social media about it, declaring them terrorists and enemy combatants. We're going to have to see whether this has a deterrent effect on these many small boats carrying relatively small amounts of drugs.
We think.
Facts reported by our colleagues, first of all, that overdose deaths in the U.S. have dropped significantly last year from a high several years back. The drug that has been killing these Americans is fentanyl, which mostly crosses in from Mexico by land. The boats that the U.S. is destroying off Venezuela, and as you said, the evidence, no, we don't have it, but If they were carrying drugs, former officials I've spoken with say that those routes from Venezuela mostly carry cocaine for Europe, not the U.S. I was recently at a discussion with a former leader of U.S. Southern Command, Admiral James Stavridis, and he was very blunt. This is not about drugs, he said. It's about intimidating Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro.
Oh, that's very interesting. Well, then what is an aircraft carrier going to do about Nicolas Maduro?
It's just another asset in what's now an armada in the Caribbean, maybe 15,000 U.S. troops. The U.S. has posted this $50 million bounty on Maduro. U.S. bombers have flown over. President Trump has talked openly about attacks on land in Venezuela and mentioned possible CIA operations in that country. There's speculation that this could be just a push to get someone in Venezuela to come out and claim that $50 million. There's speculation about a full-scale invasion or direct strikes against Maduro. We don't know. Congress doesn't really know either. The briefings have been very scant. Last week, a measure to require the Trump administration to get a legal declaration of war failed in the Senate, although a couple of Republicans did join in pushing for some sort of law.
Well, let's think about that for a second. In recent decades, it has not been that common for administrations to go to Congress in a formal way before acting, but sometimes they have tried to build some international support, make a case for intervention, line up allies. Is the U.S. doing any of that?
No, this administration has really made no effort to win over the world or the region, and these killings have strained relations with what has been America's strongest ally in counter-narcotics in the region, the Colombian military, which the U.S. has been building and training for decades. These killings of citizens from countries in the region might also put U.S. troops in legal jeopardy. Some international jurists say that U.S. military actions here are illegal, and there could be warrants out for the arrest of some of these officers who ordered the strikes. A U.S. four-star admiral, Alvin Halsley, who was overseeing these strikes, abruptly resigned last month, 2 years early. And congressional and Pentagon sources say they believe it's because he objected to these strikes on these alleged drug boats that, and this is crucial for the laws of our armed conflict, the people on these boats were showing no hostile intent. They maybe weren't even armed when the U.S. military killed them.
Well, we'll keep listening for your reporting, Quill. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Quill Lawrence of NPR's National Security Team. This is NPR News.
This is People Powered KAXC, where you get deep dives into the nature of northern Minnesota. And sometimes you get some advice.
As the season of fall is coming to a close, please consider not getting rid of all your leaves that have fallen in your yard. Leaves that litter our yards provide hiding spaces and insulation in the winter for insects and a host of small animals. Also in the spring, leaves start breaking down, releasing nitrogen and other nutrients back into the soil, making a natural fertilizer. This concludes the Phenology Report. Have a great week and be observant.
You can learn and stay curious by listening to the brand new Season Watch podcast featuring the voices of students across the region and Charlie Mitchell and John Latimer. Go to KEXC.org or Spotify or Apple to sign up for the Season Watch podcast.
You are listening to Morning Edition here on member-supported radio KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. On the River is our volunteer-hosted mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and world music on KAXE 7 days a week. Trained community members choose the music every weekday at 1 and 7, plus Saturdays at 4 and Sundays at 1. Big thanks to our dedicated volunteers. The Cass County chapter of the Isaac Walton League will host a spaghetti dinner fundraiser at Union Church in Hackensack Thursday, November 13th at 5 p.m. A presentation on nitrates followed the dinner. The classic movie series continues at the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork tomorrow. This month's film is Rio Bravo, starring John Wayne, Dean Martin, and Ricky Nelson. The movie starts at 6:30. The Bemidji Senior Center is looking for donations of holiday decorations ahead of their sale on December 5th. Donations may be dropped off at the Senior Center on 3rd Street in downtown Bemidji, weekdays from 9 to 4. And plans are underway for the 20th annual Back to Basics event on February 7th at Pine River Bacchus School. They are looking for presenters and vendors who are passionate about sustainable living. Proposals are due November 14th. Find more information at happydancingturtle.org. And the Mesabi Community Band presents a concert for veterans Thursday, November 13th at 7 p.m. at the Eveleth Auditorium. Free and open to all.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from AT&T, a network that is making connections for Americans. Connecting changes everything. Learn more at att.com/YATT. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Anna Mae Martinez. Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren is telling the Trump administration to stop plans to close parts of a key NASA facility. Staff at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland describe a campaign of chaos and destruction. Here's NPR's Katie Riddle.
The work at Goddard in recent decades has been essential in helping us understand the universe and its origins. Among the many groundbreaking projects there, the James Webb Space Telescope, Hubble Space Telescope, and OSIRIS-REx. That's the mission that sent pieces of an asteroid back to Earth. People interviewed for this story say until recently working there, it was a dream job.
I loved joining Goddard after finishing my PhD, and this was my first like real job as a professional scientist getting to work at NASA.
Casey McGrath is an astrophysicist. He spoke about this in his own capacity, not as a representative of the government. He says he loved working there for its intellect and open exchange of ideas. But earlier this year, President Trump indicated he wanted to see the center staffing cut by nearly half in his budget. After that, leadership changed and the climate took a sharp turn.
Like, we haven't had a real moment of reprieve because it feels like we're constantly being attacked pretty much on every front that we can think of.
For this story, NPR interviewed seven people who work at Goddard and reviewed internal emails and documents. Five of the people spoke on the condition of anonymity for fear of losing their jobs. Everyone interviewed described a campaign of disruption from the highest levels of leadership. An information blackout, buildings closed, labs and projects moved without warning, staff rotated off projects and reorganized chaotically. All of this has made little sense and has jeopardized the work, they say. McGrath says at least two buildings have been shut down completely.
They've even put chain and lock on the doors to prevent anyone from even entering the building at this point.
Which means they can't access specialized lab equipment like clean rooms or pipes that supply deionized water used for safely maintaining equipment. NASA did not respond to a request for comment on this story, nor did the White House. Monica Gorman is a research analyst at Goddard. She spoke in her personal capacity, not on behalf of the government. Gorman says she fears the administration is trying to cripple the entire campus and its operations.
If they do that, there are science and engineering capabilities that the United States as a whole is going to lose. And it would cost, I don't even know how many millions and millions of dollars and a really long time if we ever decided we wanted to bring that back.
One example, the Nancy Grace Roman Telescope is one of NASA's flagship projects. Among other things, this specialized telescope is helping scientists understand dark energy and the expansion of the universe. People interviewed for this story report their colleagues on the project have been reassigned or forced off the job. Engineers in the middle of the job, they say, have been ordered to suddenly move their specialized labs for the project, potentially damaging equipment and compromising the work.
They're wasting the taxpayer money that we're always trying to steward effectively, and they're throwing U.S. space science leadership in the trash.
Both Gorman and Casey McGrath say they are trying to stay here and keep working on the projects they love as long as possible. But Gorman says she and her colleagues are also angry for themselves, for the U.S. taxpayer, and for the field of science. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Green Cheese listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXE KBXE.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know, we listen to this, Green Cheese and all the other programming on the stations, we really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it. So it's really important to give what you can.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local. And given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
It would be so boring.
This is the queen, and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at KAXE.org.
After 43 days, the government shutdown could end today, but when do people get paid?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by The Economist, introducing The Economist Insider, a new video offering with twice-weekly shows featuring in-depth analysis and expertise. More at economist.com/insider.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. It remains unclear this morning exactly when SNAP food stamp benefits would start flowing again onto EBT cards. As soon as the government reopens after a House vote and presidential signature, payments would be authorized, but not instant in states that haven't managed to keep some food stamps coming in the interim. We're also tracking when the paychecks of government workers would start landing and the missing economic data. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that.
We could get the September jobs report fairly quickly once the government reopens, but there's a huge question mark over the October and November employment reports. The Bureau of Labor Statistics surveys households and businesses in the week that includes the 12th day of the month for the jobs report. That didn't happen in October because the government was shut down, and it's not happening so far this week. Gregory Dacco is chief economist at EY.
We're likely to get some data over the course of the next few weeks, but it's unlikely that we get the actual November employment report before sometime in mid to late December.
The Federal Reserve's next meeting on interest rates is December 9th and 10th, and Dacco says we'll only get a partial picture of the October labor market because the federal workers who contact households to find out who's working and who's not were furloughed. Same thing for the October Consumer Price Index, which relies on federal employees who check prices at stores. All these data delays are bad news for the Fed, Dacco says.
Because we know Fed policymakers are highly data dependent, and there have been conflicting signals from the economy as to the direction of travel of employment and inflation.
At the Fed's interest rate meeting last month, Chair Jerome Powell said a December rate cut is not a foregone conclusion. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
S&P futures are up 0.3%. NASDAQ futures are up 0.4% now. We're also doing the uncomfortable math on President Trump's idea of paying off house loans not over 10, 15, or 30 years, but over 50 years. That'll be streamable from Marketplace Online later as well. The IRS has ended the Direct File program, which lets some taxpayers do their annual returns for free using government software. Now the program is dead, and the IRS is looking to deliver free access to tax filing by other means.
For the last couple of years, and until a week ago, Americans had two options for filing their taxes for free online: Direct File and Free File.
So think about Free File as a public-private partnership
Don Moynihan is professor of public policy at the University of Michigan. That free file partnership has been around for a couple of decades. On one end is the IRS, on the other, online tax preparation companies. They provide their services for free to some taxpayers with income restrictions.
One of the limitations of free file is that it's never really broadened its horizons to get more than a couple of percentage of the taxpaying population.
Even though most taxpayers are eligible to use it. Direct File started 2 years ago as a pilot program during the Biden administration. Daniel Werfel was IRS commissioner at the time.
It was really to have a fuller menu of options for taxpayers.
With Direct File, people with relatively simple returns file directly through an online portal run by the IRS. Answer some questions, input W-2 info, and it's done. This year, about 300,000 taxpayers used Direct File.
The taxpayers that used the system said it was really easy to use. It was clear, it was intuitive. Many of them finished the process within 30 minutes.
At this point, you're probably wondering what the catch is. Well, some Republican lawmakers were looking at the cost of the Direct File program, tens of millions of dollars and counting. And they also were hearing complaints from the lobby representing tax preparation companies. Last year, during a hearing, Republican Senator Mike Crapo said Direct File was inefficient.
Were the IRS to use this year's Direct File spending to pay third-party providers to prepare and file returns instead, literally hundreds of times the number of taxpayers could file for free.
The die was cast earlier this year when the Trump administration reduced the staff working on Direct File by 80%. Last week, it officially killed the program.
How long have we been talking about free public tax preparation? 80 years.
Vanessa Williamson wrote a new book on U.S. tax history. It's called The Price of Democracy. Williamson says even though Direct File did not survive, it still laid important groundwork.
Direct File is a model for states, and it's a model for the federal government in the future if we ever decide that we want to make government services easy again.
In a report to Congress, the Treasury Department said while it's killing Direct File, it will boost Free File instead, including by increasing its promotion to taxpayers. I'm Novosafo for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Wealth Enhancement, offering its Wealth Blueprint plan through advisors nationwide. It integrates retirement, investing, taxes, and more into one plan. Learn more at wealthenhancement.com/build. And by Yubico, makers of the YubiKey. YubiKey helps protect important digital applications and services. YubiKey, still undefeated, the original passkey. More at yubico.com.
Now to Brazil for the big UN climate summit. While the U.S. has not sent an official delegation, dozens of state and local officials are now in the city of Belém. This includes California Governor Gavin Newsom, who presides over a state with a population the size of Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Finland, and Belgium combined. The BBC's environment correspondent Matt McGraw reports.
To warm applause in a hot and humid pavilion, California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom came to the COP to reassure participants that the U.S. was still committed on climate at state level. Governor Newsom wasn't alone. Around 100 state and city officials from different parts of the United States came to show their commitment to tackling rising temperatures. While the American politicians were welcomed, some delegates were a little bit wary, having seen the United States enter and leave various climate agreements over the past two decades. Longtime climate talks participant Mohamed Adao from Kenya said that while he understood that many people in the US were still committed on climate, the rest of the world wasn't going to sit around and wait for them to come back.
Matt McGrath at the Global Climate Meeting in Belém, Brazil. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. The Bemidji Senior Center is hosting free hearing screenings provided by the Lions Club Friday, November 14th at 10 a.m. No appointments needed. Tune in to KXE's new podcast, The Season Watch Pod, with hosts Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. A podcast for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. New podcasts debut Thursdays. Kotaska Community Action offers free lunch every Wednesday from 11 to 1 at their Circles of Support office, located across from Treasure Bay Printing on Northeast